Hi, I'm Gary, and this is EV Musings, a podcast about renewables, electric vehicles, and things that are interesting to electric vehicle owners. On the show today, we'll be looking at EV questions and answers. Yep, it's a Q&A episode. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Zapmap, the free-to-download app that helps EV drivers search, plan, and pay for their charging. This episode is sponsored by 3TI. They get businesses and vehicles driving on sunshine by deploying large-scale solar arrays in car parks, on wasteland and rooftops, whilst also growing an extensive, reliable EV charging network with the easy-to-install, multi-award-winning pop-up mini solar car park, Papilio 3. Find out how at www.3ti.co.uk. Now, before we start, I wanted to say thank you to everyone who sent feedback about earlier episodes this season, and indeed episodes last season. The word on the street about the last roundtable, the Women in EV roundtable, was especially good, so thank you for that. I also want to pass on my sympathies to the 3TI family after the recent passing of their CEO and former guest of the podcast, Tim Evans. Now, I've been running this podcast for the best part of 5 years now, and across 200 plus episodes, I've been able to address quite a few different varied topics around the electric vehicle and renewables world. One thing that has occurred, though, is that the number of people listening to the podcast increases every season, which is really nice. Good to hear. But what that means is that many of the people who are listening to this episode may not, for example, have listened to the episode I did back in season 4 on hybrids, or the season 5 episode on cadence charging. Which means there's going to be a lot of people out there who have different questions around EVs and renewables. So this episode, I'm going to be answering a bunch of those questions. So I polled my social media channels and asked people what sort of questions they had that needed answering. Naturally, there were many irrelevant questions, or more accurately, questions that I couldn't answer in this forum, such as when are InstaVolt or BP Pulse going to drop their ridiculously high pricing down to a reasonable level, and why is abbreviated such a long word? But in and amongst these, there were many questions, a lot of which were from new EV drivers, and I'm going to go through these one by one. If I reference a particular episode in an answer, you'll probably find a link to that episode in the show notes. So let's get started, shall we? Question 1. Are EV sales falling off a cliff? Well, the answer to that is no. There has been a lot of data thrown around from various sources and people unfamiliar with the workings of EVs. This data is being interpreted to mean something other than what it actually is. So take the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders Stats, SMMT, for vehicle sales in January. The data indicate that pure battery electric vehicle sales have gone from 13.1% of the market last January to 14.7% of the market this January. When you compare that with the same figure from last year, 12.5% of market share, you can see that sales are increasing. Not only that, the percentage of sales is of a larger overall pie. In 2022, the full market was 1,614,063 cars. In 2023, the full market was 1,903,054 cars, which is an increase of around 300,000 cars, or 18%. So EV sales are an increasing percentage of a larger pie, which means that overall, the number of vehicles being sold is increasing. In January 2022, 14,433 electric vehicles were sold. January 2023, 17,297 EVs were sold, which is a 19% increase. January 2024, 20,935 EVs were sold, a 21% increase. So this is showing an increase year on year for EV sales. We actually discussed this in episode 204 with Colin Walker.
I feel there's a real effort to jump on the figures that suggest that sales of new EVs are kind of the rate at which they're increasing is slowing a little bit. And it has in a few months. I suppose the figures in terms of overall market share of new car sales of EVs have been a little disappointing. What's forgotten in that reporting is, for example, in January, EVs are the second fastest growing fuel segment in terms of new car sales. they grew year on year by like over 20%, while petrol was like down at 7% and diesel fell 10%. The fastest growing is plug-in hybrid electric vehicles at the moment, which obviously still have a battery. But then, so this effort to then try and say, oh, but the second-hand market's crashing as well, you're like, that is literally not backed up by any data. Auto Trader have said they're finding that demand for second-hand EVs in over the past year has increased by over 60%. Used EVs are the fastest selling fuel segments on their site. An EV will spend less time being advertised before it's sold than any other type of car.
So question two, when will we see public wireless charging? Are any charge point operators developing it? Well, excellent question there from Tim O'Neill. More specifically, what is the future of public charging outside the current throwing as many chargers as possible mentality? What about plug and charge? Is this being discussed within Charge UK, for example? Well, I spoke recently to Chris Paintman-Jones, who is the new chair of Charge UK, about these topics.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting question. And again, I suppose I speak from a member's perspective. Our interest is in trying to deploy the charging infrastructure that is out there that serves vehicles that are out there on the road that people are able to buy. There is a chicken and egg situation here, which I think in the event that wireless charging is a part of the future, that the chicken and egg is that automakers are not going to deploy this within their cars if the charging infrastructure isn't there. And the charging infrastructure providers are not going to deploy this at scale because the cost involved is huge of deploying any major infrastructure unless there are vehicles that are able to try and sort of actually use the facility that you're deploying. So I suppose with either hat on, at the moment I would be saying I don't see this coming anytime soon. And when I do see it coming, I think it would be in some specific user cases. So I can see use cases for it, for example, for taxis, where you've got a vehicle who may be sitting in a location for a while, but moving in that location along a queue of vehicles. For example, I could see that working. I could also see it working from an accessibility perspective for some disabled drivers, although, as is regularly pointed out by the likes of Motability, AccessAble, Designability, disability varies dramatically from person to person. So one disabled person's needs are very different from another. So I can see some use cases for it. I suppose when I put my critical hat on, is plugging in your vehicle that difficult? And is this actually something that is needed? And really, for the cost and the transition, is it something that's going to happen? I don't know. I suppose, again, from a Charge UK perspective, whatever the direction of travel is, the Charge UK members will be trying to respond to ensure that EV charging is as easy as possible for our users.
Question three, with the UK further advanced down the contactless payments path, what's the best / common practice for getting tax or VAT receipts for charging at public charge points? Now, from my research at what the future might be, for example, it seems that the UK charge point operators require drivers to request receipts via email or web form by providing various details to identify the charge before being emailed back a receipt. Surely this cannot be so in 2024. That's a question from Shane Barrett. Now, more specifically, is there a better way to do receipts than either needing to use an app or having to scan a code, identify your session, and enter an email? Again, here's Chris Paintman-Jones, chair of Charge UK.
Again, on that one, I don't think Charge UK has a view on that. That will be down to our members to decide the best possible route for their users. Mm-hmm. None of us are incentivized to make this difficult. I do think there is and this was pointed out by Charge UK last year in terms of the move away to having to have everything contactless. When you move to a contactless experience, the very nature of that being contactless means that it's difficult to do receipts. So I think that is one that we're going to continue to work with the government on to try and make it as smooth as possible, but with the intent that every member has to try and make the user experience as simple as possible.
Question four, personal favourite of mine. Everyone likes the Tesla plug and charge functionality. Why can't every charger do plug and charge?
So I may caveat this one and say, with me being relatively new in role, this is one of the areas I'm still trying to get up to speed on. For Connected Curb, it's not such a big issue. So it's not an area where I've had a huge amount of expertise for coming to the role. So it's an area I'm trying to get up to speed on. I suppose what I can say confidently is anything that helps improve the user journey for our users across the charging industry is something that our members are going to support. I think you're right to highlight some of the technical barriers. And also, I suppose, how you make sure this is fair and equitable for all parties involved and you don't start to see CPOs being pushed sort of out of the connection with their users. I think that would probably be a concern for some members. But as I say, that's a topic that I am looking to try and increase my knowledge on.
It's a complex issue, and I hope to go into it into a little more detail in a future show. But suffice it to say that we can do plug and charge already here in the UK. IONITY have enabled it for certain cars, BMW, some Volkswagens, and Porsche. The devil, though, as always, is in the details. To make plug and charge work, you need all the parts to be speaking to each other: the charge point operator, the charger maker, the vehicle, and the payment provider. This is happening bit by bit, and this is why you can plug and charge a VW ID3 on an IONITY charger, but you can't plug and charge the same vehicle into an InstaVolt charger. Question 5. What is V2G and why is it important moving forward? V2G stands for vehicle to grid, and it's one of a number of different ways of taking energy which is stored in a vehicle battery and using it outside that vehicle. Now, to talk a little bit more about this, I want to bring in Mark Potter, who is the Chief Technology Officer of today's episode sponsor, 3TI.
I guess you have to caveat the question a little bit. So that we are already doing vehicle to grid. There's in the HGV market, there's already vehicle to grid activities underway. Trials, they seem to be very successful. The question you're probably asking is kind of the mass market vehicle to grid, right? So how far are we from passenger car supporting vehicle to grid on our homes? And the reality is we're probably about 5 years away from that being the case at the moment. The other terms, when you start talking about vehicle to grid, it's as in V2G, it's often a little bit misused. So probably the closest thing to a standardized term there is that it is taking power from the vehicle into an infrastructure charger that turns it into AC for the grid. What you also get is things like V2H and V2B language, which is normally referring to something like a V2L inverter in the vehicle that is providing AC to the building or to the home that it's connected to. So that's probably about the closest you can get to a common language. We also use the term V2V, vehicle to vehicle. And this is when on one of our systems that we can transfer energy from one vehicle to another vehicle without going via the AC network. We can do it from via a DC to DC conversion. The thing to understand with V2G, with the type that we're talking about, the DC export from a vehicle, is it's only software. There's no hardware on the vehicle needed to support it. It's exactly the same hardware that's used in DC charging. The only thing that's different is having software support to enable the charge station to take power out of the vehicle. Now, that's quite different to V2L and the AC export V2B, V2H, where the hardware on the vehicle needs to be able to output AC to a connected grid. So when it comes to the new 5118-20 standard, all that's really defining from a DC charging perspective is the software protocol which enables the vehicle to report that you can take power out of me. There's no change to the hardware on the vehicle needed to make that work. It's the same hardware. You've still got DC contactors, you've still got a battery, and nothing changes from a technical electronics perspective to enable power to come back out of the vehicle when you're taking power out on DC. Now, whether OEMs actually choose to implement the software upgrade that enables that to work on all the existing vehicles is a different story. You know, that's a kind of commercial consideration from the OEMs. They're most likely to want you to buy a new vehicle that has got the bidirectional capability built into it, when the reality is it's not actually anything new other than a layer of software. AC V2G, where you've got something in the vehicle, a bit like the V2L system, that creates the AC signal. That is quite expensive when you look at it in terms of you're adding £1,000 to the cost of every vehicle. And the other limitation is it's actually really quite tricky from both a regulatory perspective, which I'm sure we'll overcome, but also fundamentally it's going to be quite power limited, because the more power you are capable of taking out of the vehicle, the bigger that device has to be. The last thing you want to do is carry around lots of heavy power equipment on your vehicle, which only gets used when it's parked. When that market makes sense is when you've got a relatively low power, something like a 16 amp, which is what they currently do on V2L, 16 amp AC export from the vehicle to the grid. From an individual home domestic perspective, makes a lot of sense. 16 amps runs, you know, a dishwasher and an oven or you know, something like that. It's a decent amount of power. And when you aggregate thousands or hundreds of thousands of those into a grid asset, then that creates some significant grid level of power. And that's the kind of domestic use case. Now, that is probably, that's the kind of mass market thing I said earlier is probably five, six years away. In the nearer term, you've got the market space we work in, the workplace and destination opportunity that also applies up to fleets, where you're taking DC out of the vehicle, and you can do that at a much higher power level. So instead of 3.6 kilowatts, 16 amps that you'd see on the vehicle conversion, a wallbox could be doing it at 15 kilowatts or even 30 kilowatts, which is a much higher rate of transfer. So instead of a small amount of power from a lot of vehicles, you've got quite a lot of power from a small number of vehicles, smaller number of vehicles. And that becomes quite interesting in the workplace and destination and fleet market. That's why I think there's no one right answer to the AC versus DC debate. I think they both have applicability, but they have different purposes. In that domestic workplace market, it's producing a useful, meaningful amount of power for the host site that that technology is on, as the domestic one is in the domestic use case. But in a domestic use case, if you're using £1,000 extra hardware on every single vehicle, that's extra weight you're carrying the vehicle, it's extra cost on the vehicle. If you put the infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure on the wall in a workplace destination environment, well, that piece of kit is now running five, maybe even 10 vehicles in a week rather than one vehicle one or two times a week. So they're quite different. And I don't think there's one right answer. But you'll remember Gary, I waxed lyrical on having the right type of charger for the right type of application. And in workplace destination, where you've got a dwell time of somewhere, you know, between 4 and 8 hours, say, a typical 7 kilowatt charger just simply isn't fast enough. So we install 11 and 22 kilowatt chargers. Actually, they're 22 kilowatt chargers. Most EVs will take 11 kilowatts from them. And that's great because you get something like a 4 or 5 hour, maybe 6 hour charge time, depends on how flat the vehicle is when it arrives. And then if you allow for smart charging regulations, where typically in a workplace environment, you wouldn't start charging until 11 in the morning, that gives you a 5 hour window before the 4 p.m. sort of cutoff. And that is about the right speed of charging. Now, the challenge then with vehicle to grid is if you start the day by taking power out of the vehicle, you've got to put more power back into the vehicle. So one of the problems with AC charging is whilst 11 kilowatts is a good rate for that workplace destination environment, you kind of need to increase the charge rate if you want to be able to increase how much power you can take out of the vehicle. But basically, one of the good reasons for doing it in DC, not only does it give you the ability to take more power out of the vehicle, it means you can put it back in again quicker. So our DC charge point will be 30 kilowatts. They're actually bi-directional 30 kilowatts, but most vehicles at the moment, they typically limit to 15 kilowatts out, and then we put 30 kilowatts back in again. So roughly speaking, it means in that same sort of 5 hour dwell time, we can take quite a lot more power back out and then get you back to the same net charge that you would have been if you're on 11 kilowatt AC charging.
So there we are, plenty of discussions with various different people about various different topics. Let me know if you like this sort of Q&A format, and I'll put one into the calendar for next season. Now, this season, we're looking at raising the awareness of carbon literacy with our listeners. And one way we're doing that is with a carbon fact, as read by carbon literacy trainer Anne Snelson.
The top 10% of the world's population accounts for half of total emissions. The bottom 50% accounts for just 10%. Think you're not in that top 10%? Think again. That's equivalent to a salary of less than 30 grand a year.
It's time for a cool EV or renewable thing to share with your listeners. Oil company Shell is looking to expand its offerings for EV charging by transforming 100 petrol stations into EV hubs. It is committing to installing 200,000 chargers worldwide, many of which will be in place of existing petrol station pumps that are being removed. But before you get too cock-a-hoop about this, the devil, as always, is in the detail. Firstly, the majority of Shell's chargers are currently in China and will continue to be so. Secondly, the impact and expanse of these in Europe is unknown. And thirdly, in the one location where Shell have already done this in the UK, which is the Shell Recharge site at Fulham in London, the process was long and laborious and took almost 2 years to bring to fruition. But as with anything related to EV charging, if they can make it work, I will be over the moon for them. If you ever get a chance to visit the Fulham site, please do. It's pretty cool, and I was a first paying customer to use it on the day it opened. The EV Musings podcast is sponsored by Zapmap, the go-to app for EV drivers in the UK, which helps that EV drivers search, plan, and pay for their charging. Zapmap is free to download and use, with subscription plans for enhanced features, such as using Zapmap in-car, on CarPlay, or Android Auto. And that's the show for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. If you want to contact me, I can be emailed at info@evmusings.com. I'm also on Twitter at MusingsEV. If you want to support the podcast and the newsletter, please consider contributing to becoming an EV Musings patron. The link is in the show notes. Don't want to sign up for something on a monthly basis? Well, if you've enjoyed this particular episode, why not buy me a coffee? Go to coffee.com/EVMusings and you can do just that. ko-fi.com/EVMusings. Picks Apple Pay too. I have a couple of ebooks out there if you want something to read on your Kindle. So, You've Gone Electric is available on Amazon worldwide for a measly sum of 99p or equivalent, and it's a great little introduction to living with an electric car. If you're looking for installing solar panels, storage, battery and a heat pump, try So You've Gone Renewable, also available on Amazon for the same 99p. And if you've got Amazon Prime and you can use the Kindle lending library, you can read them for nothing. Why not check them both out? Links for everything we've talked about in the podcast today are in the description. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe. It's available on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave a review. It helps raise our visibility and extend our reach in search engines. If you've reached this part of the podcast and are still listening, thank you. Why not let me know you've got to this point by tweeting me at MusingsEV with the words, "Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition." Hashtag, if you know, you know. Thanks as always to my co-founder, Simon. You know, he's teaching me the best way to play three-dimensional chess. He reckons it's easy enough. You just need to be able to hold 130,000 possible combinations of moves across three layers for every move you make, anticipating what your opponent could do five moves ahead. Having said that, he did tell me,
none of us are incentivized to make this difficult.
Thanks for listening. Bye.